This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at how the Trump administration is going to tax protesters.
This is an unbelievable first, even for Trump, to tax protesters who want to come down to D.C. and express themselves, and now they got to pay to do it.
We'll also talk about the United States' imminent plan to overthrow Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro.
Top American leaders have gone down to Latin America to organize the overthrow. And just last August, there was a failed assassination attempt on the Venezuelan president by drone.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In another first for America, the Trump administration wants protesters to pay to use the public parks, sidewalks, and streets to engage in free speech. The effect of taxing protesters in the nation's capital will restrict access for First Amendment activities to the very few who can afford it. Participatory democracy will be no more. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke this August announced the White House's rewriting of regulations governing free speech and assembly on public lands under federal jurisdiction. The National Park Service will charge protesters for so-called event management expenses. Barricades and fencing that police may erect, trash removal, sanitation charges, permit application fees, even salaries of personnel deployed to monitor protests, as well as costs deemed harmful to the turf. The Park Service claims that protest-related costs are burdensome. Last year, it said that the Women's March imposed, quote, a pretty heavy cost on the government. Joining us to talk about this remarkable protest tax is attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund in Washington, D.C. Mara, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Mara, how much land does the National Park Service cover in Washington, D.C.?
Washington, D.C. is a patchwork of jurisdictions. So there is federal land, there is District of Columbia land. And when it comes to the National Park Service, when you think of virtually all of the major iconic locations where historically people have come to Washington, D.C. to stand for social change and demand justice, those are Park Service locations. That's the National Mall. That's the White House sidewalk. That's Lafayette Park. It's the Lincoln Memorial, where the 1963 March on Washington assembled. It's the broad sidewalks and parkland up and down Pennsylvania Avenue. It's so many of these locations that are under the Park Service jurisdiction and that are going to be affected by these proposed regulations.
Does the National Park Service actually own that land?
Well, this would be, I believe, the fundamental misunderstanding between the Park Service and, I would say, the people of the United States. Our public lands belong to us. They belong to the people. And the Park Service is a steward of our public lands. They are a manager of our public lands. But they act as if they own our lands, as if they are a wealthy landowner allowing us to walk on their manicured grass. And they are operating from that perspective. And that perspective fundamentally clashes with our First Amendment rights to assemble and to speak out on our public lands.
Mara, so that our listening audience can get the scope of protests that may be impacted, roughly how many permits for protests are granted compared to permits for corporate entities who use the public lands?
Well, that's an interesting fact when it comes to the Park Service's new rulemaking, which is that they're claiming that they are so terribly burdened by First Amendment activities. And then in their descriptor, they completely conflate First Amendment activities with special events, which are generally corporate-sponsored or for-profit activities that do not include First Amendment elements in them, and commercial filming. And by the Park Service's own numbers, they assert commercial filming and these special events that are generally these corporate-sponsored special events make up more than 80% of their annual permits, leaving demonstration activity to be less than 20% of the permits permit applications that they get every year. And yet, they are seeking to massively burden and restrict demonstration activity. They want to charge fees and massive costs for demonstration activity that can make demonstrations prohibitive. They're changing regulations that substantially affect demonstration activity. And all the while, the special events, you know, go forward. If they have a cost issue, they can, you know, raise the money by charging these corporate entities that use our public spaces, which is what they should be doing. Our taxpayer money shouldn't go to subsidize corporate events on public space. But when it comes to First Amendment activity, that's part and parcel of the Park Service's core mission. That's what they're supposed to be facilitating. It's what they're supposed to do. It's not an outside cost that they somehow can assess back on people who engage in free speech.
Do you have an estimate of how much a large protest could end up costing after all of the expenses are tallied up?
The numbers could be astronomical. We don't know because of the way in which they've described and promulgated the regulations. They've left a lot of these issues unexplained and very open. But by their own terms and words, the costs that could be assessed on demonstration activity could include costs of personnel, their own Park Service personnel who are assigned to handle or monitor activities, including overtime. They can charge for fencing and barricades put up at the pure discretion of the police, even if demonstration organizers don't want them. You know, they'll pin you in and then charge you for it. They want to be able to charge for what they're calling harm to turf, which in other words means that when you have a demonstration and you stand on the grass, that you're hurting the grass, and then they would send an invoice afterwards to demonstration organizers claiming that because there was a mass assembly, it harmed the grass. And notably, the grass has been rebuilt in Washington, D.C., in many of these locations with hyper-resilient grass and irrigation systems, but they still want to treat our green spaces really like they're ornamental. And these costs could be in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. It can create a situation and will create a situation where people who want to demonstrate either can't even afford the upfront costs necessary to access our public space or risk bankrupting invoices and fees charged after the fact.
I know, and I think our audience will remember that the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund has litigated some important First Amendment cases, not only in D.C., but also here in New York, including the Central Park case. Can you remind us what the Supreme Court has to say about the use of public land for protest?
The Supreme Court, for beginning with its seminal 1939 Hague v. Ohio case, has talked about our public spaces, our public lands from time immemorial, not just here in the United States, but around the world, that public spaces, our parks, our sidewalks, our streets, are held out for use by citizens to discuss the important debates, the important issues of any time. And that is the fundamental understanding of what public space is. It's for assembly, it's for speech, it's for discussion, it's for debate. It is for, here in the United States, First Amendment activity. But that's all being turned on its head with this idea that somehow First Amendment activity and free speech activity runs contrary to the interests of our public lands. That's just not true.
Mara, I want to read, because I think it's so eloquent, a paragraph from the 1939 Supreme Court decision on public land for protest. The court wrote, "Wherever the title of streets and parks may rest, they have immemorially been held in trust for the use of the public and, time out of mind, have been used for purposes of assembly, communicating thoughts between citizens, and discussing public questions. Such use of streets and public places has, from ancient times, been part of a privileges, immunities, rights, and liberties of citizens. So that's what was said in 1939, and now that's under attack, isn't it?
It is under attack. We're seeing it not just with the National Park Service regulations, but we're seeing this as an assault occurring all across the United States with anti-protest laws that are being put forward by legislatures, many of their members who are basically on the payroll of corporate interests and fossil fuels industries. So there's really an attack on free speech that's occurring by legislative and regulatory and legal means. And it is an attack that can be stopped, but it can only be stopped by people standing up and fighting in opposition. We're organizing in opposition to the Park Service regulations. People can come to our website at justiceonline.org, where there are dozens of groups who are joining together in an informal network who we are working with, who are going to be taking action in opposition to the Park Service regulations. It's important that individuals take action to comment on the Park Service regulations, and there's information about how to do that from our website, because when these regulations are put out for public comment and the comment period is open right now, people have the ability to go in and submit comments to the government and tell them that they stand in opposition to these regulatory changes, to any efforts to burden and restrict our First Amendment rights. And these regulations were carefully crafted and put in place incrementally over 50 years of constitutional rights litigation, where time and again people had to go to the courts and get the courts to order the Park Service to manage the permitting system in a lawful and constitutionally sound manner. And now this administration believes that it can, of its own accord, just overturn five decades of litigation and eviscerate these rules.
Mara, discretionary fees or measures that can serve as a proxy for content-based discrimination are unconstitutional. When do you expect legal challenges to mount?
We are preparing for a legal challenge now. The process goes through a regulatory process where, as we said, this goes out for public comment. Then the Park Service will have to respond to those public comments when it promulgates final rulemaking. When it does promulgate final rulemaking, to the extent that they go forward with these different restrictions, and there's more than a dozen major changes. It's not just the pay-to-protest element. There are other major changes that will completely restrict and disrupt the ability to demonstrate, then if they go forward with those, and given this administration, there's much likelihood that they will, we at the PCJF are preparing to litigate. We will expect to go in quickly and try and seek an injunction to stop these rules from taking effect.
Yeah, they even want to narrow down to 5 feet the pedestrian walkway in front of the White House, a place that I've been able to demonstrate a number of times, and now they want to only give us 5 feet. But let me switch the focus of our discussion, Mara, if you will, because if Brett Kavanaugh gets on the Supreme Court, that'll mean at least a 5-4 majority for people who would, I think, look favorably upon these new Trump regulations. And I wanted to ask you about that.
In terms of, to address quickly, the White House sidewalk, what they're actually doing is closing the White House sidewalk to protest. I mean, this is an iconic location where, you know, we all have the images in our head of, you know, the suffrage movement protesting there, of women marching against lynching, of the anti-war movement, environmental rights, LGBT. Everyone has come to that location. And administrations going back to the Vietnam War era had attempted to close it, and the federal courts told them that they couldn't, but this administration is actually closing it, and they didn't even publicly disclose that in the narrative portion of the regulatory materials they put out. The only reason we know about it is because our organization did a line-by-line review of the regulations and saw it in there without even proper notice or disclosure. So that's going to be a huge change to shut the White House sidewalk to protest. And of course, as this case and other civil rights, civil liberties cases make their way to the Supreme Court, with the addition of someone like Judge Kavanaugh, there will be an extreme 5-4 that I think will have an incredible impact on our rights as we move forward. But I think we also have to recognize that if somehow Kavanaugh is not confirmed, that, you know, the next person that's going to be nominated by this administration is going to be someone who probably would not rule much differently than he would. I suppose they can, you know, they had a couple women on the short list, and maybe they'll go for one of the right-wing women, because then they can at least assume that they won't get complaints that they sexually assaulted people in their earlier years.
I never thought about that. Good point. Mara, Michael and I were chatting earlier about the astonishing fact, although I guess we shouldn't be surprised by anything in the last couple of weeks, that Brett Kavanaugh's attorney is actually communicating with the FBI over their investigation. Do you know anything more about that?
I don't, but it's clear that throughout this process, it's, you know, it's a deeply political process, and really the curtain has been pulled back on what happens behind the scenes in terms of the White House, in terms of the investigation and a background investigation. There was information suggesting that Kavanaugh himself was reaching out to people to build his defense against one of the women that stepped forward to accuse him of misconduct. But I think what we have to really recognize here is that what stands out about Kavanaugh may not really be so much his politics or the inner workings, but the fact that it's been just so grotesquely exposed to the American public. And when you think about the Supreme Court, you know, we're all taught and trained, and, you know, those of us are lawyers, but the American public as well, the people, are trained to sort of venerate everyone on the court as if once you have that black robe on, you're somehow almost godlike in your ability to analyze and think. Even if you disagree with somebody's political positions, there's, you know, such an effort to really elevate them on this pedestal status. And the thing about the Kavanaugh hearings is it's stripping away that veneer. And people, I think for the first time, are really going to be able to look at the justices on the Supreme Court and understand that, for the most part, the justices on the Supreme Court are extremely rich. They have gone to, you know, the most elite law schools, Harvard and Yale, and that they are so far removed and non-representative of the vast majority of the people of the United States, all of whom are affected by their rulings. It's really a disconnect that, for the first time, I think, is being highlighted by this process.
Yeah, I would describe Kavanaugh as a far-right Republican operative, really a hitman. He broke into the scene in helping Bush steal the election in Florida in the year 2000. He was part of that team. Then he was part of the White House team that facilitated getting around the American international law against torture. Those papers and what he did were never released to the Senate, so we don't know the details of that, but he was part of that. And I think he was awarded, just like Jay Bybee was awarded a federal judgeship, John Yoo was awarded a professorship at Berkeley, and Kavanaugh was awarded a seat on the district court. And then he went from there to the Court of Appeals. And the interesting thing is that very rarely did he ever vote in the interest of the public. I mean, this guy can be counted on to support corporations against workers, to support the government against protesters. I mean, his decisions have been awful. That aspect of it all has been pretty much ignored by the fact that he's also a woman hater.
I think that's very true in terms of what his background is, and as, you know, as a just really a, you know, a political player, or as some might say, a political hack. But, you know, I think that we shouldn't have illusions overall about the court. I mean, the court, regardless of whether they came in through a Democrat or Republican administration, more often than not, all of those justices stand on the side of corporations and stand on the side of the police. And when it comes to what the people of the United States need in terms of justice and defense of their constitutional rights, There are certainly some members who are worse than others, but really, across the board, all of them stand more often in defense of corporate interests and the police.
I would add that the American Bar Association is also not as reflective of the needs of the people across the nation, and that if we had a more diverse bar association that wasn't as corporate-minded, we might also have an entity that helps vet Supreme Court justices in a more just fashion.
I would characterize the Supreme Court as really the last line of defense of the ruling elite in this country. They've never, except for several decades, in the late 50s up to the early 70s, they've never really done the right thing. They viewed that slavery was okay and that black people were property in the Dred Scott decision. They viewed in the Plessy versus Ferguson that separate but equal was okay. And then later on with Brown versus the Board of Education in the 50s, they had to rule because they were looking like such hypocrites that school segregation was not good. But even then, their ruling was not end desegregation. It was with all due deliberate speed. And now it's been some 60 years and schools are still segregated. So it is really an extremely conservative body that was set up back in the 18th century by a group of white men, many of them slave owners, and it served to protect the interests of the very rich and the corporate powers against the people to this day. And now I think with Kavanaugh, they're just reinforcing the role of that court.
You know, where the court has ever ruled in terms of social change, social justice issues, and ruled in the right way, it has always been behind and following the movement of people. So it's always been that the change has come because of a shift in political consciousness, because of the fight of people on the ground and in the streets over fundamental rights, and then the court has come along after that. It has never been a leader in forging rights for the population.
Yeah, well, they're very cautious, you know. They don't want to get too far ahead of public opinion, and they don't want to get too far behind public opinion because they want to preserve their legitimacy. And what's interesting to me is because Dr. Ford was so persuasive, they don't care so much about their legitimacy anymore because it's just a overt power play, and that's what they're going to do to us.
I have to wonder, though, whether or not some members of the right wing and even the right wing on the court would have to feel uncomfortable about the illegitimacy of the court once Kavanaugh is on it. It really is going to change that whole perspective, that sort of accepted veneration of the court. I think that's a real tension, even while there's a strong desire to put him on. I think that's an actual real tension, because if they could replace him with someone who would do just as much damage but wasn't himself so delegitimized, it would serve right-wing interests better.
Well, I agree with you, except that Trump's MO is to double down, which he's done. He gave a speech at what he calls a campaign rally in Mississippi the other day where he mocked Professor Ford. And Kavanaugh says he's not going to back down. He's not going to withdraw. So I think even though they certainly will delegitimize the court in a way by putting him on it, I think they're going to do it.
I also just want to add, Mara, you referenced the public persona. And we've seen in the last week such a caricature of Kavanaugh from Matt Damon doing a fabulous job imitating him on Saturday Night Live to Stephen Colbert every night. I marvel at Kavanaugh's tenacity in hanging in there when his reputation in the public eye has really been made fun of, ridiculed, and so diminished. So to me, that says something about his lack of character.
Well, he's grown up wealthy, elite, in circumstances where his path has been laid before him, despite his claims that he had to, quote, work his butt off to get where he was. I think most people know that just really doesn't ring true for, you know, his life circumstances. And he has expected that he would receive his ultimate coronation as Supreme Court Justice. He has no desire to not achieve that if he thinks it's still within his grasp. Character, I think, plays no role in this when it comes to him, or it's certainly, you know, acting out of good character. I mean, even when you look at his belligerent testimony, which was, you know, alternating between belligerence and yelling and this crying, sobbing, which honestly just really made me think of, like, little kids when they're having temper tantrums, you know, that and they start crying, it's not fair, and they're alternating between yelling and crying. And I can't imagine, like, you've never seen an adult person do this. And as many have said, can you imagine someone doing that on a job interview, which is what this was? And yet, he's obviously, you know, hanging in there because he wants this position. And if there's any way that he can get it, he's going to get it.
Mara, unfortunately, we're out of time. It's definitely been an exciting couple of weeks, and we're so glad to have you on, not only to talk about Kavanaugh, but to tell us about what's happening with the protest laws, or as you say, the protest tax in D.C. So we look forward to hearing about that, and also urging our listeners to think about submitting public comments.
Mara, before we have to go, could you tell us again about the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund?
Well, the Partnership for Civil Justice, we're a nonprofit legal organization, and we handle a lot of constitutional rights, civil rights matters. We are reachable through our website, which is justiceonline.org. That's justiceonline, all one word, .org, where you can get information about making comments into the record through an online form submission. And we really urge people all over the country to come and do this, because we can have this ability to push this back. And this impacts everyone in the United States who wants to come to the nation's capital and exercise their First Amendment rights.
We'll share that information on our website.
And we'll do it.
Yes. Thank you, Mara.
Thank you so much, Mara. You take it easy.
Thank you for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Recently, people in the Trump administration held secret meetings with certain military leaders of Venezuela to discuss plans to overthrow Venezuelan elected President Nicolas Maduro. The White House said in a statement that it was important to engage in, quote, dialogue with all Venezuelans who demonstrate a desire for democracy in order to bring positive change to a country that has suffered so much under Maduro. In August, there was a failed assassination by drone attempt on Maduro's life. The economic situation in Venezuela has been dire. This has been exacerbated by a U.S. financial embargo. It is estimated that 1,600,000 people have left Venezuela since 2015. Today, we speak with William Camacaro. He is a Venezuelan citizen living in New York City and a senior research fellow at the Council of Hemispheric Affairs in Washington, D.C. This is a non-governmental organization that was founded in 1975. Camacaro is a co-founder of the Alberto Lovera Bolivarian Circle of New York, an organization founded in solidarity with Venezuela. William Camacaro, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
William, given the meetings in the Trump administration that Michael just referenced with certain military leaders of Venezuela, is there a danger of an American-supported coup?
Well, we'd make a little history. And we can, if we go back 15 years, 20 years, since the Bolivarian Revolution started, we can see that the United States always has been trying to overthrow the Venezuelan government. In the case of President Chavez was overthrown in 2002. Then they organized a coup d'etat, and there was a so-called oil strike in December 2002-2003 against President Chavez, where the oil industry was completely stopped, and the country lost more than $10 billion. So we have Venezuela since the project of the Bolivarian Revolution took office, took power in Venezuela. The United States have been trying to overthrow this project. I think that is something basically that we should know. There is two different doctrines here. One that is the Monroe Doctrine that was made by James Monroe in 1823. And at the same time, it's the Simón Bolívar Doctrine. Simón Bolívar basically said, quote, "The United States seems destined by the providence to pledge the America of misery in the name of freedom." So, and Simón Bolívar was looking for the integration of the entire South America country to confront the interests that the big brother in the North has in the entire region.
So, William, is there an imminent danger, in your opinion, of an American-sponsored military coup against the Venezuelan government?
Definitely. There is a danger to have any kind of military coup, any kind of process to overthrow the Venezuelan government. If you see, for example, let me give you some example, that the people that have been talking about the need to have a coup or regime change in Venezuela from the Trump administration, we had the Defense Secretary, James Mattis. We have Rex Tillerson, that when he was Secretary of State. We had the USA Ambassador, Nikki Haley, that have been very active, and also recently in the summit, in the UN summit that took place just a few days ago, she went to say hello to some Venezuelan right wing that were demonstrating in the street against the Venezuelan president, and she had a megaphone and she was supporting them from the street. That's something completely illegal. No one really can organize, can go to the street. Imagine if the Venezuelan ambassador in the UN go to the street to support some people that are demonstrating again with a big megaphone to support some people that are demonstrating against Donald Trump. That's completely illegal. So that was something that Nikki Haley did just a few days ago. Then we have Ted Cruz, Ileana Ross, Marco Rubio, that all the time is talking about the need to have a regime change in Venezuela. So we have also Luis Almagro, who is the Secretary General in the OAS, and also we have Carlos Trujillo, the USA Ambassador in the OAS, that has been also saying and talking about the need to have a regime change in Venezuela. If you add to that list that also one of the biggest allies of the United States in the region, Colombia, is also talking about the president of Colombia, the new president of Colombia, Duque, is also talking about the need to regime change and to have a military forces to liberate Venezuela from the oppression. So it's something that is in the place. We have already 36 American and NATO bases around Venezuela, 36. And we have, in addition to that, we have to know that Colombia is a new member of NATO. So it's not a coincidence. They are preparing an scenario, a conflicted scenario, and we are going to see something that we are going to see something similar to Iraq, to Libya, something very close to what happened in those countries.
Is President Maduro vulnerable, and if so, why?
Well, it is right now because, as you know, when President Chavez was in power, the entire region, Chavez has an entire region's allies. They have Lula was in power, Correa was also in Ecuador, Lula was in Brazil, the Kirchner were in Argentina. There were big allies around. Right now, the entire region has shifted to the right, and it's in all those countries together with United States, with the support of United States, are basically sabotaging the economy, helping United States with all these sanctions, in providing all the resources to undermine the economy of Venezuela. For example, let me give you an example. Venezuela is selling electricity to Brazil. and Brazil is not paying the electricity to Venezuela. In Brazil owned to the Venezuelan government over $60 million because they said that they cannot pay to Venezuela because if they pay the electricity that they're getting from the Venezuelan government, they will get some kind of penalty from the sanctions of the United States.
Talk about the support that Maduro and his government are getting. Who supports him?
This is very interesting because President Maduro, since he came to power, he has been an enormous pressure from the United States. Obama was the first one to initiate all this process with the decree. Did you remember the decree? Venezuelan is an unusual and extraordinary threat to the security of the United States. So if that's by law, United States, you know, the president of the United States had to pass that decree, and then after that, they can pass all the sanctions against the Venezuelan government. So is that the first step to pass all the sanctions that we are, you know, facing right now?
Let's talk about the economic situation. Is it fair to say that the economy in Venezuela is in crisis?
Yes, it's in crisis. People had day by day problems to buy food, to buy certain basic elements like, for example, medicine. I was in Venezuela last year 6 months, and I had to come back because I was not able to get my medicines. People are not able to get insulin. People are not able to get basic stuff because, again, the sanctions doesn't allow the government to get all this. To buy in an international market. Even the staff of the diplomat that the state has around the globe, they have problem to pay them. Sometimes they don't pay to the staff on 3, 4, 5 months. So you have some diplomats around, but you don't have the money, or you have the money, but you don't. But all the bank has been, you know, the account bank has been closed. The account bank has been closed. The Venezuelan account bank have been closed, and it's very difficult for the Venezuelan government to pay to his own diplomats around the globe. The economy inside is terrible, so there is no cash because the cash is terrible. Everything has to pay by debit card or credit card because there is no cash, because the cash has been sucked. The entire cash is in Colombia, Venezuelan currency. It's in Colombia or other country in South America. Those that are suffering more this situation are people that have small business. If you are selling something in the street or selling food, and most of the people are not able to buy what you're selling because you don't have cash. You need to pay with debit card. The majority of those small businesses don't have the reading machine for credit card or debit card.
Is this embargo, the financial embargo by the United States of America, is this illegal?
Oh, completely illegal. Of course it's illegal. It's something that is completely illegal because most of the people that are suffering the consequences, the biggest population, the entire population in the country. But it's illegal, even by the United Nations. United Nations is talk about those illegal measures. And they have been saying that the United States has to eliminate the sanctions against Venezuela. It's basically a blockade. It's similar to what happened to Cuba. What's going on in Venezuela. If you remember a few years ago when, again, Obama passed the decree declaring Venezuela an unusual, extraordinary threat to the national security, before that, he was talking to the Cuban. He said, no, the sanctions doesn't work. You remember that speech with the Cuban president, and after he spoke to the Cuban president, he was saying that the sanctions doesn't work, that Cuba is there for 60 years resisting the sanctions. And then next day, a few days after, he imposed the sanctions against Venezuela.
President Maduro was recently elected in a democratic election. Please talk about that.
Yes, I was in May 20, when the day of the election, I went to Venezuela. People went to vote. For the first time since I have been voting in Venezuela, I noticed during this revolutionary process in Venezuela, I noted that people were very quiet, no talking too much, and no celebrating. But people were voting for the government because they knew what that meant for the Venezuelan people, the confrontation that was coming from the United States. After that election, immediately Donald Trump imposed new sanctions to Venezuela. I have to say that a lot of people don't know in the United States that at least 35% of the population are completely solid in support of Maduro. 35%. That's a huge amount of people that support the government. Then you have like around 30% that move to the left, to the right, and you have another close 30% of people that are right-wing, that are completely divided, and that they really don't, right now, they don't have a leadership in Venezuela. There was around 800, there were just around 800 international observers in the election on May 20 from all over the planet.
William, when the news got out that the United States had been in contact with military figures in Venezuela, the White House said in a statement that it was important to engage in a, quote, dialogue with all Venezuelans who demonstrate a desire for democracy in order to bring positive change to a country that has suffered so much under Maduro.
How do you view the United States policy when it comes to bringing democracy to Latin America? And now I'm thinking about the United States' actions in Nicaragua, Cuba, El Salvador, Dominican Republic. You think this is just an element of hypocrisy here?
Yes, of course it is. It's a United States, as I, you know, we know within Latin Americans, the United States has been always moving around the continent just defending the corporate interests of the United States. Not even the American people interest, just the corporate interest, the big transnational interests. And basically those interests always get crushed with the interests of the people and the continent. I just remember when the coup happened in Venezuela, hundreds of people died when President Chavez was the president, and hundreds of people died during that coup against him. And the city, Caracas City was completely like a ghost. No one was on the street. And you see in the faces of the people, worriness, uncertainty, because they didn't know what was going on. And we don't expect anything good from the United States. Is that I have to say it's something that the Mexicans say. Mexicans say, so far from God and too close to United States.
After it became known that the U.S. had been talking with certain Venezuelan military leaders, was there a concern in the American government that Latin American countries would not support an American intervention in Venezuela?
Yeah, the majority of the country, they don't want any USA intervention in Venezuela, military intervention. In fact, a few days ago, Mr. Almagro, Luis Almagro, the Secretary General from the OAS, he went to Cúcuta, and he said that the possibilities of military intervention is possible in Venezuela. He said that in the border with Venezuela. This is a person that is coming from a multilateral organization, talking like the war is possible and it's a possibility. So after that happened, the group, the Lima group, that is a group formed by 11 countries that are under working with United States to try to overthrow the Venezuelan government, the Lima group for the first time they published a document establishing a different with the Secretary General of the OAS, saying that they don't want any military intervention against Venezuela. And the only one that didn't subscribe the letter was the President of Colombia.
In the year 1998, Hugo Chavez was elected President of Venezuela. Then a few years later, the military, with the support of the United States, the Venezuelan Catholic Church, the media, and right-wing trade unions, staged a coup d'etat. And Chavez was removed from power, but that only lasted for 47 hours. Mm-hmm. And he was able to, with popular support, get back in. Can Maduro count on this kind of popular support today?
Yes. And basically, you know, after the May 20, when he won the elections, when we realized that more than 35% of the people support President Maduro. Solid, very solid. The people that, whatever happened, they will be behind him. And there is a similar number of people that they move to the left, to the right. But the other problem that the right wing, they have another problem that the right wing have in Venezuela is that they don't have a leadership. And people have realized, even their own people, even the right wing in Venezuela, they don't want any military intervention or USA intervention in Venezuela. And that's the big difference that they have with the right wing leadership. And for that reason, these people that are supporting the base of the right wing in Venezuela, they don't mobilize to vote because they don't want any USA intervention in Venezuela.
I wanted to ask you, as we're coming to the end of our allotted time, William, what's at stake here for the United States? It's just not that Venezuela is rich in oil and gold, but in terms of geopolitical consideration, what's at stake?
I would say three things. You know, the one that is Venezuela and the project of the Bolivarian Revolution, the idea is to implement a participatory political economic democracy, so where people can participate. It's not like United States, the people is represented by someone. It's people participating in the democracy. That's one problem for the big corporations. But the other problem is that Venezuela is trying to put power over the population, so they through the participatory democracy. At the same time, it's trying to build or multilateral organization without the United States participation in South America, like UNASUR with Latin South American country and CELAC with entire Latin American and Caribbean countries. So, and of course, United States is again that in the last summit in 2015 with Obama, Correa said to Obama, he said, the OAS is the place to talk to United States. All of us will be talking to you there. But the CELAC and the UNASUR is the place for us to talk about us. And that's very interesting to see President Obama's reaction at that moment. That was normal. It was obviously uncomfortable.
William, how can our listeners learn more about your work in solidarity efforts with Venezuela?
Yes, we have a website that's CV Alberto Lovera, C as a child, B as a boy, Alberto.
Say that again and slowly, please.
CB, C as a child, B as a boy, Alberto Lovera at gmail.com. You can write it to us there, but also, if you Google that name, you will get the website. We have a website with big numbers of articles. And also you can check Venezuela Analysis. That is a website also dedicated only to Venezuelan issues.
William, thank you so much for joining us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, William.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's been our pleasure.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof 104.5 FM Radio, Anchorage, Alaska, WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF-FM 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio, 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
We dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI, 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO, 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT, 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS, 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA, 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our streaming planet podcast, WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRNLP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYRLP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising online. KBFG 107.3, Seattle, Washington. And KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB LP 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODXLP 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJPLP 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.